No, 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 sir. Emergency.
Yeah, somebody got shot. It's by the Phil Sunoco.
Okay, what's the address there, sir?
I don't know. 7209, I think.
Okay, somebody got shot.
The guy is dead.
Laying there, man.
He's laying on the car.
We got a guy just shot out here. I'm on the corner of Chalmia and Georgia Street.
So what's going on there?
There's a dude just got shot here at the intersection.
3 weeks in October 2002, a time seared into our memories.
But stepping over the line, shooting a kid, I guess it's getting to be really, really personal now.
Absolute horror. This isn't supposed to happen in a community like this.
As two murderous snipers encircled the Washington, D.C. area, a time when we all realized that our life or death in those 22 days was just a matter of chance.
Welcome back to 3 Weeks of Hell, the D.C. Snipers. This is episode 7 now. I'm Bob Barnard, Fox 5 reporter here.
And I'm Melanie Allnwick, and in this episode, we're going to now just dive into that third week of the killings that just continued relentlessly in the D.C. area. We know that there were three more shootings that week. That's right. There was a federal worker who was shot in Virginia. Everybody remembers that Home Depot shooting. We also had a Montgomery County bus driver who was just starting his route for the day, like so many of us, just going off to work, getting ready, getting started. The fear really just settling in, something that just wouldn't let go. And the investigation was starting to narrow, as you're going to learn in this episode. Clues were starting to come in, puzzle pieces starting to fall together. But still, the snipers remained elusive and deadly in their aim.
The first terrifying murder that last week of the snipers' killing spree was on a Monday night, October 14th, in Falls Church, Virginia, in the parking lot of the Home Depot on Route 7, Leesburg Pike. The victim, a 47-year-old woman, an employee of the FBI, Linda Franklin. She was shot in the head, killed instantly.
Linda was a loving wife and mother who watched out for everyone in her family, and her loss will affect everyone.
It's a loss that hits home to the law enforcement community, too. Franklin worked for the FBI as a civilian intelligence operations specialist, fighting cyber crimes.
Linda's family is shocked by the senseless loss of life and is calling on anyone with any information about this tragedy to contact law enforcement, the FBI, Fairfax County, whomever.
That was from our news broadcasts the following day.
Just hearing that it was down the street at Home Depot was shocking.
And at the Home Depot, candles and flowers now rest where Franklin was gunned down, a makeshift memorial for another innocent victim of the serial sniper.
That was our colleague Maureen Ume's voice you heard there. She also covered the sniper's killing spree from the night of the very first shooting right to the end. Now, Melanie, you covered the trial of Lee Boyd Malvo for the shooting death, the murder of Linda Franklin. One of the more horrifying pieces of evidence played at that trial was the 911 call made by Linda Franklin's husband from the parking lot at that Home Depot there in Falls Church moments after she was shot dead.
It was really gripping. You know, you have those moments that stay with you. And I have to say that that 911 call played in open court was something that has stayed with me. And I think everyone who covered that trial for years and years, it literally just drops you. And you have so much respect for the families of the victims who have to sit there in open court and listen to this and literally relive the worst moment of their entire life, the worst night of their life. You know, and you always debate. You and I talked about how much of this call should we play.
Right. It's heartbreaking, it's graphic, and yet it does remind people of what that time was like, right? So we are going to play it, right?
A portion of it. And the reason is because we just feel like, in the most heartbreaking way, it really does represent the anguish that these loved ones, these family members went through.
Hello?
Yes, I'm
calm
here.
Calm down. Where are you at?
I am at the Home Depot.
Home Depot?
On Route 50.
Route 50?
Yes.
So your husband shot?
My wife.
Your wife is shot?
Yes.
Okay. Where has she been shot?
She shot in the head.
Okay. Route 50, sir?
No, I don't know.
Okay, what's your name, sir?
William Franklin.
Franklin?
Franklin.
Franklin?
Yes.
Family prefers that Linda's remembered for her adventurous spirit, her tenacious mind, and for the love and friendship that just fell out of her, as a childhood friend told the Virginian Pilot. Here's her sister Susan after a memorial service in her hometown of Gainesville, Florida.
The hardest part is just knowing I won't ever see Lindy again, and just all the suffering that so many people are going through, not only my own family, but for every other family. Truly, my heart breaks for every one of them. To be quite honest, I'm numb right now. I'm just not really sure how I feel, except for that I pray that it's over.
Now, Bob, I did reach out to Linda Franklin's family. Understandably, they didn't want to be interviewed for the podcast, and we totally respect that. It's not for everyone. People
Absolutely.
Sometimes just want to focus on the future and not the past, and that's all good with us. But I did exchange texts with Katrina Hannum, who's Linda Franklin's daughter, and here's what she told me about her mother. She said she was an intelligent, kind, giving person whose legacy is carried on through her grandchildren. And then she mentioned that we could follow Linda's granddaughter on her Instagram or Facebook pages at Linda's Lab. She's 10 years old, and she's a gifted kid scientist, and she's named after her grandmother in honor of her legacy. At 10 years old, Linda is in the process of becoming the CEO of her own nonprofit corporation. Katrina says, like her grandmother, the younger Linda is incredibly gifted in math and science and is so proud to be named after a woman who wanted to put good into the world as she does.
For federal investigators, the killing of Linda Franklin struck home. Retired ATF Special Agent Mike Bouchard, one of the lead investigators on the case, took it kind of personally.
You know, I still remember one of the media members was asking us, you know, this has to be a trained sniper, has to be former police, former military. And I said, this does not, with this type of firearm, in the distances the shots are being taken from, doesn't have to be an expert marksman. Well, two victims before that were shot in the torso, and Ms. Franklin was shot in the head. And to me, I felt like they thought I was challenging them. You don't think I'm that good of a shot. You just kind of wonder what your words are and how they're being interpreted, when you're out in a press conference.
Now, a slight crack in the case came Wednesday, October 17th. Another call from the snipers to the tip line telling police to look into a previous shooting. The evidence existed, but John McCarthy, then the legal advisor to the task force, says it was another frustrating failure to connect the dots.
And they basically gave him a tip to look into Montgomery, Alabama. And when they did, they found out that there had been a shooting on September the 21st in Montgomery, Alabama, with the same weapon. And they had seized a gun magazine. Sitting outside of the liquor store that was robbed in that particular night, where two women were shot. One was killed, one was injured pretty seriously. Waiting for them to close, they were leafleting through a gun magazine. They left the gun magazine on the hill. It was seized by the police. A fingerprint was developed on the magazine, but Alabama at the time did not participate in the national fingerprint. They didn't pay their $100 or whatever it was. They didn't have access to the national computer database for fingerprinting. It was frustrating in the end to realize that we had this information and they would have been looking for Lee Boyd Malvo connected to the Alabama case if Alabama had access to the national database, but they did not.
Saturday, October 19th, 2 days after that call, and unfortunately before detectives were able to get the evidence from the Alabama shooting, a man named Jeffrey Hopper and his wife stopped at the Ponderosa Steakhouse in Ashland, Virginia. It's right off I-95. The couple were driving home to Florida from Pennsylvania and made the decision not to stop for dinner in the D.C. area because of the sniper's killings, unaware that there had already been two shootings in nearby Spotsylvania County, Virginia. 43-year-old Carolyn Sewell shot and wounded in a shopping center parking lot on October 4th, and 53-year-old Kenneth Bridges, who was killed at an Exxon station October 11th, just 30 minutes up I-95 from Ashland. As the Hoppers left the Ponderosa restaurant just a little after 8 p.m., another single shot rang out. Ashland Police Officer Tim Meachin was first on the scene that night.
I got on scene 2 minutes response time, and I see a woman who's sitting on the sidewalk of the Ponderosa, and then there's a man who's laying in the parking lot, but his head, she's cradling his head as she's sitting on the sidewalk. So I pull down past them, and I get out of the car, and there's an older couple, probably in their mid-70s at least, and they're just kind of confused. They have this confused look, like, what's going on? The woman that was sitting on the sidewalk, later identified as Stephanie Hopper, she said, he's been shot, and it came from there, and she pointed towards the woods behind the Ponderosa.
If his name and voice sound familiar, it's because in our last episode, Tim Meachin told you about his close encounter with the sniper's Chevy Caprice in an Ashland hotel parking lot. Now, roughly 24 hours later, the killers had driven that car to the nearby Ponderosa Steakhouse and opened fire on another random victim.
And then I turned my attention to Jeff and Stephanie. And I asked what happened, and Stephanie told me they were walking out of the Ponderosa. They had just finished eating. They were walking out, and the older couple was in front of them. And they were just talking, leaving a restaurant, and that's when they heard the shot. And Jeff kind of doubled over a little bit, put his hand on his stomach, and then he just kind of slowly started going down to the ground. And Stephanie's like, what's wrong? What's wrong? She helps him down to the ground, and he says, I think I've been shot.
Minutes later, Meachin says the first ambulance arrived, but stayed back since nobody knew whether the killers were still there. Eventually, Meachin says he got his department-issued shotgun and told the ambulance crew to move in.
I was making myself a target, you know, by providing the armed escort of the ambulance and making them feel safe so that they can come in and grab Jeff and get him to where he needs to be, which was the trauma center. So, you know, I'm thinking this, and right after we had established the final perimeter for the crime scene, investigators from the sheriff's office start to arrive.
And so did the feds.
An ATF canine actually found where the shot was taken from by locating the spent shell casing. And that was, you know, that helped us a lot because it took us right into the woods, found the note. Their DNA, all those kind of things.
But also they found on the scene that night, they found a candy bar wrapper, and they found like a potato chip snack bag that was empty. And those were laying in proximity to the note that had been tacked on the tree. And of course they found a casing from a bullet from a .223 rifle round. So it really kind of was a treasure trove of evidence that had been left behind.
In that wooded area, retired ATF agent Mike Bouchard says investigators found a 4-page letter from the snipers demanding $10 million.
The last note after it, the Ponderosa, was put $10 million in this Bank of America account. It was an ATM card. I want to say that back then, I think you could only draw $200 at a time, and you get your picture taken when you do it. So we kind of said it's a non-starter, but more importantly, that card had been stolen and canceled. So there's no way to revalidate a canceled card with the banks. So we had to communicate through the media to these guys. We'd like to give you the money, but the method you asked for is not possible. You need to reach out to us so we can talk about it.
Here was Montgomery County Police Chief Charles Moose speaking before a sea of live news cameras at the time.
We have researched the option you stated and found that it is not possible electronically to comply in the manner that you requested. However, we remain open and ready to talk to you about the options you have mentioned.
Do you think they were messing with you or were ignorant that you couldn't do it that way?
No, I think they were just messing with us. I think they felt a control thing. Let's see if we can get them to give us money or go out publicly and offer us money.
And that maybe there was a way you could activate the card and make it happen.
Yeah, I they weren't the smartest two in the bunch, but they also had that term, we want you to say we caught the goose in a noose or something like that, some humiliating statement that they wanted the chief to say. And again, that led us to believe this is a control thing. They want to play games.
Again, Ashland, Virginia police officer Tim Meacham.
And they said, if catching us is more important, get your body bags. And then that's when they made the threat to, they did, they said, get your body bags. And they made this threat to the children, your children are not safe anywhere, anytime.
Meaning, give us the money, don't try to catch us.
Correct.
This was sniper Lee Boyd Malvo in a phone call made to the Ponderosa restaurant, as the snipers said they would, telling investigators they'd contact them at 6 a.m. Sunday, October 20th. The number was rerouted to the FBI.
Hello?
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 Yes.
Is this the Ponderosa?
Who is this?
Don't say anything. Just listen.
Then he appears to play a recording. Now that was kind of hard to hear, but Malvo said, Mr. Policeman, call me God. He said, do not release this to the press, but tell the media we've caught the sniper like a duck in a noose. And at the end there, P.S., your children are not safe. Malvo, as likely instructed by John Allen Muhammad, insisted Chief Moose say that on live TV.
Your children are not safe anywhere at any time.
It had a chilling effect.
You know, and at that same time, right around that same time, all the superintendents of the schools, Maryland, Virginia, all got together with us and said, we're going to close all the schools down. we want you to tell us what to do. We're like, I can't tell you what to do. You can close the schools down if you want. What we told them is, I know when my kid is in school for 6 hours, that's 6 hours I don't have to worry about them. If they're home, now they're going to be outside running around. And we also said, you know, if you keep all the kids home, guess what? At least one of the parents has to stay home too. So now you are going to have to deal with the employers. You're increasing the risk on these children by having them out running around. Not that you can control that, but it's a given. So they changed their minds and had the kids go to school. Some, I think a couple of them canceled school for a day or two, but then we were able to tie this together and solve it.
Investigators knew they were racing the clock, and an FBI agent from Mobile, Alabama, was racing to task force headquarters in Rockville, Maryland, arriving on Monday, October 21st, with evidence from the Montgomery, Alabama liquor store shooting, a fingerprint taken from a magazine, and a shell casing, but not soon enough as the high-stakes game of deadly phone tag continued.
It is important that we do this without anyone else getting hurt. Call us at the same number you used before to obtain the 800 number that you have requested. You indicated that this is about more than violence. We are waiting to hear from you.
And sadly, the snipers did reply with another murder the very next morning.
We have reports this morning of a shooting reported to police at 5:57 this morning. We're flying now in the area of Connecticut and Grand Prix, just north of the Wheaton area, where there is a huge police presence.
Conrad Johnson was a 35-year-old father of two and a ride-on bus driver. That's the name of the local commuter bus service. He was shot and killed before dawn on October 22nd, standing near the driver's seat of his bus, as it was parked in the Aspen Hill area of Montgomery County, Maryland. And yes, Aspen Hill was where one of the first of the sniper's victims was shot and killed a couple of weeks earlier. This from our traffic reporter at the time, flying in Sky Fox.
obviously, as we've seen with some of the other shootings in the last few weeks, police are putting out quite a wide dragnet here, doing some roadblocks, some checkpoints all around the area.
So, Bob, I learned from Montgomery County State's Attorney John McCarthy that initially investigators wondered if that other bus driver was somehow connected to the killings. You're about to hear him talk about this experience, and he's going to say a name that certainly you and our listeners in the D.C. area are going to remember very well.
He and the other bus driver would meet each morning. They had a stage at a particular location, and then you left from that staging area to run your various routes so that you got to the locations at the right time. They would sit, drink their coffee, get on the bus, and then go do their routes. The woman who he was having coffee with was Rafael Edmonds' sister. Rafael Edmonds is the biggest drug dealer in the history of Washington, D.C. When he was killed, people initially at some point in time thought, does this tie back to Rafael Edmonds and drug dealing in Washington, D.C.? Within about a half hour of thinking, oh my God, this is Rafael Edmonds' sister, they found another tarot card. It was the D.C. snipers. But initially, it was like, holy shit. Is somebody trying to kill Rafael Edmonds' sister over a drug deal?
Hours later, the FBI fingerprint database would produce a match for Lee Boyd Malvo. But by then, despite heroic measures by trauma surgeons at Bethesda Suburban Hospital, Conrad Johnson passed away.
Conrad loved his kids, loved his wife. I mean, he loved family. He really emphasized family. There was nothing more important than family.
As these sniper killings were continuing to make headlines across the nation and around the world, it was clear the killers were growing more bold and angry. Remember in our last episode, the phone call from a frustrated Lee Malvo to one of the hotlines.
City police, love calls, this line is recorded.
Good morning. Don't say anything, just listen. Where are the people that are causing the killing in your area? Look on the tarot card. It says, call me God. Do not release the press. We have called you three times before, trying to set up negotiations. We've got no response. People have died.
Yes, sir. I need to report you to that Montgomery County Police Hotline. We're not investigating the crime. You like the number?
You have to wonder whether that call taker was ever told she had one of the snipers on the line and let him go. As the people in charge, that must have been frustrating to know, whether it was at the time or later, that these guys were actually calling us and they got kind of lost in the shuffle.
Yeah, I think we had over 110,000 calls during those 3 weeks. And on one, typically it was 5,000 calls a day. One day there was 10,000 calls. And the lines got overrun. Eventually they had 100 lines set up with operators taking these calls. It's unfortunate some of these calls fell through the cracks and didn't get addressed timely. But, you know, we did our best as we could with the situation.
And how did you then know at some point, besides the notes being left, that, oh, these guys are listening to us, they do want us to engage in some way?
Well, a lot of the things that got leaked, and that problem just got worse as the whole thing went on. We were engaging with them, but their responses back in writing were, do not release this to the press. If you do, there's going to be more victims. And on these notes, they would have red stars for every victim that they shot. And, you know, the next note after it got leaked, you know, there's another star on it. So, again, we have to go out and, without saying, hey, we're not going to say it in front of the press that we have a leak problem. People can draw that conclusion themselves. But we tried to convey that message to these guys that it wasn't us that released it. We're not intentionally doing what you're asking us not to do. So again, weaving that in through our press conferences as a means of communicating, that did draw them out, because each correspondence after that, they would get put more in writing if there was a note. Eventually, they got aggravated with the phone calls, and because they weren't getting addressed timely by mistake, they made that mistake of calling the priest and saying we were the shooters in Montgomery. I mean, that was beginning to the end for them.
Yes, Malvo and Mohammed called a priest, and that priest helped investigators inch ever closer to identifying the killers.
That tip and some other leads focused investigators' attention on two men from the West Coast who would become suspects.
All right, back live now. Let's talk briefly about this person that has now been released publicly here, who police are looking for. Federal arrest warrant has been issued for this man. Take a look. He is 42-year-old John Allen Muhammad, also known as John Allen Williams.
John Muhammad Williams, or a John Allen Williams, or a Muhammad Williams as well. We also had a name up there of a 17-year-old juvenile that is also a person of interest in this case.
Lee Malveaux. And within hours, the two would be arrested in their Chevy Caprice in a rest stop along Interstate 70 in Myersville, Maryland, about 50 miles north of D.C. More on their capture, interrogation, and trials in a future episode.
Wild to think that it was finally over, you know, but it was so intense for so long. And then, like, almost immediately after the names were put out there, who these two guys were and what they were driving, they were caught.
Yeah. And I think what's really sits with me about this particular episode is, once again, those near misses, the things that you can look back on and say, if only this had come together, if only this had happened, if only the guy from Alabama had gotten to police headquarters a few days earlier, if only the call takers had known who they were dealing with. So many opportunities, like we said with the Chevy Caprice, right? Where things could have been wrapped up so much sooner in this case.
And if you're Jeffrey Hopper and his wife Stephanie, you know, you're trying to avoid the DC area when you're driving home to Florida, and so you stop down near Richmond, and we'll have dinner, and you get, you know, he gets shot. He survived, and we reached out to him as well, right?
We did, and again, understandably, it's just not their thing. And we wish them well.
And it's weird, like all those phone calls from Lee Boyd Malvo, obviously egged on, you would think, from Muhammad, the older one of the two. You wonder what that was about. Were they just trying to mess with police? Were they like surprised they hadn't been caught? Did they want to get caught? It was strange, the taunting nature of what those guys were up to in their phone calls.
And we've heard from so many people in law enforcement, they have never dealt with anything like this before. And so it was really just kind of, like you said, like an accordion. Toward the end of week three, the pressure was building on everybody. The clues were starting to line up. Things were coming together. And then we get to the evening of October 23rd, when the FBI knocked on the door of a townhouse in Clinton, Maryland, where Mildred Muhammad was living with her three kids, and said to her, "We're going to name your ex-husband, John Allen Muhammad, the DC sniper."
And she is the focus of our next episode.
And we hope you do join us for that. You can, of course, follow us on all of our Fox 5 social media platforms. You can watch this on YouTube. Go back and watch episode 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
All the way back, yeah. And wherever you get your podcasts. And again, we hope you tune in next week as we hear more from the ex-wife of one of the killers, the mastermind behind this crazy killing spree.
All right. See you next time.